My dear Boot, I send you an account of a new anodyne process lately introduced here, which promises to be one of the important discoveries of the present age. It has rendered many patients insensible to pain during surgical operations and other causes of suffering. Limbs and breasts have been amputated, arteries tied, tumors extirpated, and many hundreds of teeth extracted, without any consciousness of the least pain on the part of the patient.
Jacob Bigelow sits at his desk, and with a quick hand, scratches out a letter to a friend in London. Jacob is a physician and a teacher at Harvard Medical School, and as his pen moves back and forth from inkpot to page, he details the news of a medical marvel. Surgery without pain.
The inventor is Dr. Morton, a dentist of this city, and the process consists of the inhalation of the vapor of ether to the point of intoxication. I send you the Boston Daily Advertiser, which contains an article written by my son Henry, and which is extracted from a medical journal relating to the discovery. The newspaper will give you the details up to its date, since which other operations have been performed with uniform success.
Now the world had ether, how were people going to use it? As doctors tried to work that out, what was it like for the patients? And could they make it better? My name is Matthew Herron, and this is Ether Ore. It's the story of the history of anesthesia, the gases we once used to put people to sleep, and how the safety of patients became central to a modern specialty. Ether had arrived in a world grappling with the rapid pace of the Industrial Revolution. So in a time where almost every aspect of life was changing, what difference would it really make? Clues can be found in some very unusual places. Lying in the shadow of the Shard, one of the latest additions to London's skyline, hidden away in an 18th century church, is one of the most surprising leftovers from Victorian healthcare. Climb the 52 narrow stairs to the church's attic, and you'll find a museum that can tell us a lot about how healthcare was changing, even before the news of ether arrived in England. The Old Operating Theatre Museum and Herb Garrett houses the oldest surviving operating theatre in Europe, and not, as I wrongly suggested, the second oldest. Dr. Monica Walker, the museum's engagement and front-of-house manager, was quick to correct me.
Now, please do not take us the crown away. But we are the second oldest one in the world. The first one is actually the Ether Dome in Boston. That one predates us by 2 years. It's actually a really interesting comparison because in many ways they're very similar. I mean, this is a time when the cheapest way to actually construct anything is wood. So both of the operating theaters are made out of wood. And every time that people say wood, you know, that's not very hygienic. Of course not, you know, but this is the type of building material that they have. Ours is not a seated operating theater. It's not that big. And they wanted to have the largest amount of students possible. You had to pay to actually see the operations, even if you were a student. The more students that you had, the more money that the surgeons will make. Our operating theater, which is not really large, could actually hold up to 120 students, but it's a standing operating theater. I think we have five rows. One, two, three, four. Actually, we do. Five rows. I got it right. We have five rows, you know, in a hemicycle with the operating table at the center. And of course, a humongous skylight.
The museum and its operating theater are an extraordinary record of the changing landscape of 19th century surgery. But the improvised use of a church attic gives us an insight into the new demands being placed on healthcare. Surgery was becoming increasingly professionalized, and that meant more students who needed teaching, and importantly, who would pay to be taught. Society was changing too, and in its improvised attic home, the old operating theatre gives us a clue to another revolution taking place.
And St. Thomas's had the operating theatre on the men's wards installed in 1755. Women were operated upon in the women's wards in the same space where the rest of the patients were. And then they will have three beds like placed very close to the window in the ward, and that's where they will operate upon them. we have this question a lot. So if there was an operating theater for the men in 1755, why did they have to wait until 1822 to make the women's operating theater? And then some people like to see that as being like, well, they didn't care about women. It's not really because of not wanting to care for women. It has to do with the idea that, you know, before the Industrial Revolution, women were mostly working in homes, right? They were inside domestic spheres. You know, the types of injuries that they had were not that severe. I mean, if you compare that to the life of men in that time who were sailors, soldiers, miners, porters, when they got hurt, you know, they really got hurt. The type of hurt that will require operations in the operating theater. But after, you know, the advent of the Industrial Revolution and women entering more and more and more into the workforce, especially the industrial workforce, more women starting to have the type of accidents that the men have. It's not until 1822 where there is enough places for women to actually merit the opening of an operating theater. So when people ask, you know, how this space came to be, it was just by chance, because the women's wards of St. Thomas's were wall to wall to the attic of the church. And because the attic already belonged to the hospital, it was a really easy way of just opening a passageway between the women's wards and the attic.
The museum is a staging post between barbarism and modern practice. And it reminds us that the changing culture of healthcare isn't just dependent on advances in medical science. As society evolves and medical needs change, our healthcare systems have to change too. And that's as true today as it was then. The old St. Thomas's Hospital, by improvising an operating theatre in the attic of an adjacent church, was responding to an increase in demand for medical education from young men wanting to become surgeons, and to the increase in women who were needing surgery.
It's not just an exhibition where there are cases with objects, or exhibition is the space itself. This is where countless women went through horrifying, you know, surgical procedures from 1822 until 1862. Pre-anesthesia, during anesthesia, completely pre-antiseptics. And the fact that you get to see, you know, our collection, which also incorporates things, you know, from obstetrics, we have an incredible midwifery kind of like cases, domestic medicine as well, not just surgery and the development of anesthesia and antiseptics, but just really looking at all of these different elements and thinking about how they came into being and how people's lives were at that time period where none of these advancements had been introduced. And yet we're here today.
For me, this is what makes the Old Operating Theatre Museum and Herb Garrett so intriguing. The space is the exhibition, and that gives us the chance to stand where it all really happened and wonder what it would have been like to watch, or perhaps more gruesomely, to be operated on in this space.
So the advancements of surgery in the 19th century, at the beginning, they seem to be very slow, but then it picked up speed, and that happened because of the introduction of two very important things into medicine, which were, of course, anesthesia and antiseptics. In the Victorian era, when ether was introduced, it was like, it spread like wildfire. This was like incredible. You know, it was news everywhere. So people were really expectant seeing how all of these things were taking place, you know, as they were taking place, these new developments that were changing the face of medicine and history.
It's easy to think that once ether arrived, everyone was sound asleep during their amputations and trephinations in operating theatres like Monica's. But that wasn't really the case. Not to begin with, anyway. Now doctors were starting to use ether. They'd have to answer questions like, how much do I give? And how do you know when it's worked? And for the patients, that meant their experiences could be alarmingly different.
The reality is that years went by before everyone got anaesthetised. It was complicated.
Dr. Christine Ball is an anaesthetist in Melbourne, and she's a prominent figure in anaesthesia history too. She's an honorary curator at the Geoffrey K. Museum of Anaesthetic History in Melbourne and Wood Library Museum of Anaesthesia laureate.
And ether is not an easy anesthetic to learn how to use. It smells disgusting. It makes people choke. It makes people salivate. It causes terrible postoperative nausea and vomiting. And it's quite slow in onset. So you get the four stages of anesthesia where the second and third, really, they're quite excitable and they need restraining in a way. And so that was pretty confronting for people. You know, no one had done this before. No one had given an inhaled agent to somebody else. People had inhaled things for various reasons, but they'd never actually held a mask over someone else's face and made them breathe it. So that was part of the problem. The second thing is that originally they just didn't have great apparatus. So they were using pipes into people's mouths so people could breathe through their nose around it. Ether evaporates quickly and takes heat out of the air. So then the container you're using freezes and so it stops working. People panicked. And that happened a lot over the next few months, that people started having anaesthetic and gave up on it, or people refused anaesthesia, or, you know, they got halfway through an anaesthetic and it all got really complicated and everybody gave up. But it was by no means straightforward.
In one case series published, a dental surgeon documented his disappointment at the varying effects of ether vapour for tooth extractions. A 16-year-old girl, he wrote, had become snappish after inhaling ether for 2 or 3 minutes and then refused to take any more of it. Worse still, a woman in her 40s had become furious and unmanageable. She still consented to have the tooth extracted once she'd calmed down, but it was certainly not pain-free.
They still didn't know exactly what was going on. You know, originally, most of the people that were using anesthesia, they were just like doing it by, you know, so do you call it by eye? You know how you say that in English? Like, they're just like, okay, I think that this is enough, you know? I don't care. Maybe it needs a little bit more. Maybe a little bit more. A dash more of this, you know? Yeah, it'll be fine, you know? There was absolutely no notion of that idea that, you know, depending on your constitution, your weight, et cetera, that you needed to be administered a certain amount of the substance.
The famous surgeon Robert Liston fared better with his attempts. The amputation he performed on December the 21st, 1846, would be remembered as the first operation in England to use ether. "I tried the ether inhalation today," he wrote, "in a case of amputation of the thigh, and with the most perfect and satisfactory results." For some patients, ether meant anesthesia almost as we understand it today. For others, it meant coughing, nausea, or agitation. It was strange for the surgeons, too. Before ether, the success of an operation depended upon the skill of the surgeon, but the compliance of the patient was also important. Liston had taught his students that a surgeon must be assisted by the patient or he cannot succeed. Now, in a post-anesthetic world, surgeons didn't have to worry that a writhing patient would risk them cutting off their own fingers. Now patients would lie on the operating table, disconcertingly, in the surgeon's eyes, like the cadavers on which they learnt their trade. Life was changing rapidly outside the operating theatre and within it, and as doctors trialled ether in spaces like the old operating theatre, experiencing its benefits and its drawbacks, the Victorian desire for innovation would seek new solutions to ether's problems. And in those solutions, new objections to the very concept of anesthesia would be raised.
Edinburgh University and the Royal College of Surgeons were well established as centres of learning in the 19th century. Simpson, he became the professor of midwifery, aged just 28, in 1840.
Dr. Alistair McKenzie, consultant anaesthetist at the Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, can tell us more about how James Young Simpson, the Scottish obstetrician, transformed anaesthesia.
He was the youngest of a family of many children, born about 25 miles west of Edinburgh. Members of the family felt that Simpson really needed their help because he showed great promise. So they helped him financially to attend the University of Edinburgh. he proceeded to graduate in medicine and then went to work as in general practice, where he encountered some obstetrics. He was encouraged by one of his senior colleagues to go into the then rather unattractive discipline of midwifery. And he was enthused by the introduction of Ether. He was a very confident and daring, you might say, person. He wasn't afraid to experiment with new techniques.
Simpson had already experimented with drugs to relieve the pain of turning babies in the womb during contractions, but nothing had worked very well. In early 1847, just a few months after Morton's ether demonstration, he began experimenting with ether in his own obstetric practice.
A woman was brought into the maternity hospital on the 28th of February after being in labour for 30 or 40 hours. Subsequently to her entering the hospital at 7 p.m, scarcely any decided uterine contraction could be said to take place. And when I saw her at 4 a.m. of the following morning, little or no advance whatever had been made. She was made to inhale equal parts of sulfuric ether and tincture of ergot. In the course of a few minutes, a series of extremely powerful uterine contractions supervened, and the child was born within a quarter of an hour of the commencement of the inhalation. The mother subsequently declared that she recollected nothing at all of her delivery.
Simpson was initially impressed with ether, and wrote a glowing report about his use of it in obstetrics. But as he began to use it, he would begin to realise that ether had its problems.
And he wrote a glowing report about the use of ether in obstetrics, but he himself was dissatisfied with ether as an anaesthetic agent in obstetrics in particular. Delivery obviously could be a protracted process, so the attending obstetrician giving ether for analgesia would have a long time of it. Ether is bad smelling. By the end of the procedure, the obstetrician's clothing would smell highly of ether. Also, over a long time, could make some patients nauseous. Secondly, most of the deliveries in those days were conducted in patients' homes. So the obstetrician, including Simpson, would have to lug heavy bottles of ether up the flights of stairs of the tenements in which the locals lived, which was another displeasure. And finally, the rooms in the tenements did not have many windows, and they were lit by candlelight, and of course, ether is explosive.
So there were plenty of reasons why Simpson looked for something new. Organic chemistry at this time was flourishing, and there were plenty of new compounds to experiment with. Chloroform had been discovered in 1831. It's the stuff we see in movies, poured on rags and held over mouth and nose until the victim passes out. Simpson actually didn't think chloroform appeared particularly promising to begin with. As a liquid, it was heavy, and it wasn't volatile like ether, which would easily evaporate at room temperature. So he'd stored away the small bottle he'd sourced from an Edinburgh chemist. But one night, at a dinner party at his home, he and his assistants sat down to their usual entertainment, testing Simpson's latest collection of compounds. None of them worked, and Simpson began to wonder about that small bottle of chloroform.
And he tried numerous inhalational agents, experimenting with them on himself and on animals. There is a story that he tried ethylene dibromide on two rabbits and was then about to try it on himself when his colleague suggested that he should first check on the rabbits, which were, of course, dead. It seems that his junior assistant, James Matthews Duncan, actually was the first to try chloroform. But Simpson never gave any credit to that event, if indeed it happened. At a dinner party at his home, number 52 Queen Street in Edinburgh, on the 4th of November 1847, Simpson and his two assistants, James Matthews Duncan and George Keith, all inhaled chloroform and under the influence collapsed onto the floor. And on awakening himself, Simpson realized that here was an agent far stronger than ether.
If his first thought on waking was that chloroform was much stronger than ether, his second thought was that he was now lying face down on his dining room floor.
One assistant was lying twisted under a chair, snoring with his mouth hanging open. The other was thrashing his legs around so violently that they threatened to knock the table over.
And he wasted no time in trying it in obstetrics. Within a week, he had used it in obstetrics, and within 2 weeks, he published a report on 50 cases of the use of chloroform as an anesthetic. He then went on to champion the use of chloroform and the use of this form of analgesia in obstetrics. Of course, he had already tried ether, but now found what he considered a superior agent.
Ether had its problems, but now here was chloroform, apparently a better choice. It was easier to administer, caused no irritation, and better maintained deep anesthesia. Less of it was needed, so fewer heavy bottles had to be carried up tenement staircases for anesthesia given in the home. And, as Simpson specifically stressed, chloroform was not flammable, an important consideration given homes were lit by candlelight. Simpson was so impressed with chloroform and its advantages over ether that he began promoting its use. Henry Lang Gordon wrote in his biography of Simpson that he saw chloroform as the only anesthetic, with ether just a stage in the history of this greater agent. Simpson was enthusiastic, but his evangelism over chloroform wasn't totally without opposition. Other doctors were concerned that more patients would die as a consequence of anesthesia, believing that pain in surgery was desirable and even protective. Simpson countered these arguments with statistics, collecting records of surgeries and deaths from hospitals around the UK. He wrote, "There are few or none of the operations deemed justifiable in surgery that are more fearfully fatal in their results than the amputation of the thigh. Its mortality rate was estimated to be as high as 70%, but in the data Simpson collected, he could show that with the introduction of anesthesia, it had fallen to just 25%. He'd countered the medical argument against anesthesia, but there were still objections. In the church attic of London's old Operating Theatre Museum, medicine and religion found common ground for medical progress. James Young Simpson helped to lay that foundation with his work on chloroform, because his other critic was the church, and in tackling religious opposition, he'd establish a cornerstone of modern anesthetic practice. Simpson's early experiences of witnessing surgery made him sympathetic to the plight of patients. They'd prepare for surgery like a criminal condemned to death, counting the days, listening for the echo of the surgeon's carriage in the street, before giving themselves over to the dressers who would hold them down while the surgeon picked up the knife. As Simpson began his career in obstetrics, those early experiences of surgery would inform his work as a professor of midwifery. Ether had taken away the horror of surgery, but the pain of childbirth was also great. As patients suffered on the operating table, women suffered during labour, and now Simpson had a drug that could provide relief. He began to use anaesthesia in complicated obstetric procedures like deliveries that required the use of forceps. But he'd also start to use anaesthesia in labours that required no specific interventions at all. And this is an important point, because unlike in surgery, where ether would numb the pain of an operation needed to treat a disease, Simpson's use of ether and then chloroform in otherwise uncomplicated labour, a natural process, was different. He was administering it simply for the pain relief it offered. That was new. And for some people, that distinction would be problematic.
The obstetric anaesthetist is a subspecialty today. Not all anaesthetists do obstetric anaesthesia. And of course, it has been completely transformed since the 1960s when epidural analgesia was introduced.
Simpson had established the use of anaesthesia in obstetrics. And today, obstetric anaesthesia remains an integral part of anaesthetic practice.
Hospital delivery suites have a dedicated anaesthetist 24 hours a day, giving anaesthesia for planned and emergency cesarean sections, and providing pain relief for women in labour. Epidurals are the most complicated method of pain relief in maternity care. We use a small needle to pass a plastic tube into the back. When the needle is removed, the tube stays in place, and it's used to give pain-relieving drugs. When epidurals work well, they're incredibly effective, but they're not without their own risks, and not every labouring woman wants one. Decisions about pain relief in labour are complex and personal. Some women request it early, while others prefer to go without it altogether. Today, anaesthetists are available to discuss the options and support women in making a decision that makes sense for them. But before anaesthesia existed, women had been getting on with labour pains for thousands of years. And in Simpson's day, as he trialled chloroform in labour, some felt that women should continue doing just that.
Surgery at the time, apart from delivery, was a smash and grab affair because they didn't have the analgesia. The patient was given alcoholic beverages, held down by strong men, and the use of straps, and the surgery was done as fast as possible. And that's why the best surgeons were the fastest surgeons in those days. Childbirth, by definition, didn't conform to the same time scale, and so it was different. As a new idea, many of the medical practitioners themselves opposed it initially. The first to mention that there might be religious objections was Edward Murphy. He was the professor of obstetrics at University College London, and in a pamphlet or small book that he wrote on the use of chloroform in obstetrics in 1855. So Murphy had introduced the idea that the church as a body opposed the use of analgesia in obstetrics, but there's been a lot of debate about this, and several authors have embellished the religious objections. Later, books on the history of anaesthesia really went to town on this religious objections aspect. Perhaps the main book to embellish it was that by Andrew Dixon White in 1896, where he went on to say that from pulpit after pulpit, Simpson's use of chloroform was denounced as impious and contrary to Holy Writ. But it has since been investigated, and although greatly embellished, it's clear that there must have been something going on. It's interesting that soon after the release of chloroform, he published a report or a pamphlet, Answer to Religious Objections of Use of Anesthetics in Midwifery.
Simpson couldn't use statistics in his pamphlet answering the religious objections, but he could respond to the theological arguments which arose from a chapter in Genesis as Adam and Eve are being cast out of the Garden of Eden. Unto the woman, God says, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children. Over 23 pages, Simpson set out his rebuttal, analysing the language and the translation of the text from the original Hebrew, turning the argument on its head.
But I believe that there must have been some form of objection, but this came from patients rather than theologians themselves. I found a register of deliveries at the Edinburgh Maternity Hospital, and I was able to compare the use of anaesthesia in the 11 months preceding Simpson's paper, Answer to Religious Objections, with the 11 months following that. And there was a statistically relevant increase in the use of anaesthesia after his paper. Even today, there are groups of people who believe that pain is something that should be suffered, to at least some degree before rushing off to get relief from it as a service to God or for other reasons. I don't think Simpson felt the religious objections were a major problem, but he was very clever at self-promotion and getting the public on his side, and publishing that pamphlet really is the sort of thing that would get the attention of the public and popularize his introduction of chloroform.
The religious objections might have died out, but controversies around pain relief in labour continue to be a modern problem. In early 2020, a story ran in the UK press. Women in labour, it was reported, were being refused epidurals for pain relief. The story, based on the results of an inquiry by the government into childbirth across the UK, was an important reminder to healthcare staff working in maternity services that pain relief in labour is an integral part of maternity care. Epidural use in the UK is rising, and reasons for refusal were cited as a combination of gatekeeping by healthcare staff, an extended workforce struggling to meet demand, and, to quote the article directly, a cult of natural childbirth. It seems the idea that labour is meant to be hard work persists into the 21st century. What also persists, though, is Simpson's belief that pain relief in labour is an essential element of the care for women having babies. Whatever your view of the natural process of childbirth being medicalised, the option for pain relief in labour should be available to anyone who wants it. It seems, on this point, we still have some work to do. William Morton had performed his ether demonstration in October of 1846, and just over a year later, by November 1847, James Young Simpson had trialled ether on his own patients, elucidated the problems that came with it, and found in chloroform something that, in his mind at least, was superior. In his work in obstetrics, Simpson railed against moral and religious perspectives to bring pain relief to any labouring woman who wanted it. That's an ideal we still strive for today, whether we achieve it 100% of the time or not. The clarity of Simpson's central tenet had been born out of his own pioneering work. He'd shown that doctors exist to alleviate human suffering and preserve life. And for spaces like the old operating theatre, the days of having four men to hold a patient down were coming to an end. Now, just one man would suffice, provided he had the right drug and knew how to use it. Simpson's eager promotion of chloroform would lead to its use worldwide. But as more patients received it, it would become clear that this more powerful drug could have powerful effects, and the consequences could be disastrous. The religious opposition might have been overcome, but soon a new medical concern would be raised, and James Young Simpson's insistence that chloroform was superior to ether would set Edinburgh against London, and chloroform would leave a lot of people dead. That's next time on Ether Ore. Thanks go to Dr. Monica Walker from London's Old Operating Theatre Museum and Herb Garrett. Find out more at oldoperatingtheatre.com. Thanks also to Dr. Christine Ball and Dr. Alistair McKenzie for their expertise. The voice of Jacob Bigelow was provided by Adam Unns. Adam is the host of the podcast The Spark Parade, where he geeks out with artists and entertainers about their spark of cultural inspiration. Listen wherever you find your podcasts. The voice of James Young Simpson was provided by broadcaster and journalist Alan Jenkins. Our music was composed by Nicola Chang, and this episode was written, recorded, and edited by me, Matthew Herron. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Ether Ore. It helps other people find the show. Thanks for listening.